Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. Get behind the wheel of your new Opel at the Opel Open Road event now on at your Opel dealer.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, joining me to chew over the week that was Michael McNamara, independent TD for Clare, Patricia McBride, political commentator and Irish news columnist, Dr. Cara Augustenberg, even environmental research fellow at UCD, and Neil Richmond, Fine Gael TD. The environment has been very much top of the agenda throughout the course of the week. Cara Augustenberg, who's joining us actually from Inishbofin, has it been windy enough for you in the course of the last few days over there?
A little bit stormy, but luckily the weather passes quickly over Inishbofin.
One of the, I don't know if it's even a full stop is the best way to describe it, but the next kind of installment in all of the shock and horror stories from the IPCC that's coming our way is the news as leaked by a Spanish newspaper to The Guardian, or picked up by The Guardian, that the scientists behind what will be the third installment of this report have some very, very disturbing news for us, Cara.
Yeah, you know, it's not a surprise to those of us who have been following these reports since they began in 1988. And, you know, the news keeps getting worse. And I think the language of the IPCC keeps getting worse. I mean, we went from reports in the early 2000s that said it was somewhat likely or likely that humans were contributing to climate change. Now we're seeing words like unequivocal and extremely likely. And their language is certainly getting more alarmist, but it's based on the reality of how the Earth is responding to our behaviors.
But now the scientists are saying, or the group of scientists who have leaked this particular document, that we have to make emissions peak 4 years from now, that they have to be reducing from then if the planet is to remain livable.
I think it ties in well with the first working group's report, which said that in all cases, they looked at five different scenarios. And even in the best case scenario, they acknowledged that we will overshoot this idea of the 1.5 degree of warming. How soon, I think, remains to be seen. And it sounds like this report that's being leaked is saying it will happen even faster than people expect. But we really kicked the can down the road way too long now and left it too late in the sense to stay below 1.5. But yet we still need to keep working to make sure that we don't reach, say, 5 or 7 degrees of warming by the end of the century, which would be absolutely catastrophic for humanity.
Michael, what was your reaction when you heard or read about these reports?
Obviously, I wasn't surprised. I mean, I think it's been clear for a long time that climate change and tackling climate change is the major issue of our times. And we do need to tackle it. But I suppose how we tackle it now remains the question to be decided. I mean, we have a carbon budget coming up in Ireland soon, hopefully. But unfortunately, because of the mechanism introduced by the government, the Dáil will have very little input into that. It will have far less input into that than it would into a fiscal budget, for example. And I think most people would agree that this is as important as a fiscal budget at this stage and needs to be equitable and fair. And we need to bring people with us on this. And I don't think you do that by taking power away from the Dáil in the way that was done with the Climate Action Bill earlier this year.
Come back to the Dáil in a moment. Patricia McBride, did you expect to hear more from the government on this?
Well, I would have expected to hear more, but I mean, even before the IPCC reports were coming out earlier this week, 2 weeks ago, there was an article in the Journal where Vice Admiral Mark Mellitz of the Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces was interviewed, and he said that climate change was probably one of the greatest threats to Ireland. And you look at the things that we've been dealing with in terms of flooding, in terms of the recent, even the fires on the Hill of Howth, and the Defence Forces being brought in to fight all of those things. But greater than that, we need to look at the impact globally that climate change is having and how Ireland can contribute to stopping that. And that includes things like, you know, how we generate energy. I know that there are provisions being made in government to increase the amount of renewable energy that we're using, but we have to do it much more quickly. And we have to look at things that perhaps were previously unpalatable, such as nuclear fuel and how that can be used in an environmentally friendly way. We can't just keep, you know, saying to consumers, you must reduce your own carbon footprint. It has to be done in a much more cohesive, cross-cutting way where everybody is responsible, governments and individuals alike.
Shocking reports, Neil Richmond, that really revealed all of the extreme weather events that we have been seeing is climate change. And yes, I think the texts, the context that we've had from the listening audience is, where's the sense of urgency? Where's the sense of reassuring us that they are actually doing something about this from the government?
Well, I think it was interesting that within minutes of the report being released, we had the relevant line minister in Morning Ireland going through exactly what the government is doing. The legislation that Michael referred to in terms of the Climate Action Bill passed last June is the largest piece of legislation in this area that ever has gone before the state. We will see the climate budget coming up in the coming weeks and months, and a lot of the work that we need to do has been started. It does, I agree, absolutely need to be sped up, and we need to make sure that when we approach this issue, it's not just about all the changes I have to make and I suppose the stick approach, but also there is a lot of opportunities for people in this to realise that tackling the climate emergency is something that everyone can embrace and do well out of. It's not just the right thing to do, but it's also something you know, to reward people in terms of carbon harvesting and all the other opportunities.
Everyone can embrace it, but I think everyone would also think that you had a number of jobs. You had four jobs here, really. And transport, you've been told by the motoring industry, there's no way you're going to get the 1 million electric vehicles that you're looking for. On agriculture, the government has ignored what the scientists have to say about reducing the national herd. On housing, you've been told, retrofitting of housing, you've been told this week by Professor John Fitzgerald once again, you're just not going to get the 20,000 skilled labourers that you need for that programme. And on energy, the data centres that we are allowing to continue to be built are going to mean that we're probably not going to meet our renewable energy targets. So you've failed on the four things that people were expecting government to do already.
No, I reject that. To say we failed and just to point to four opinions, I think, is simplifying what is obviously the most complex and most challenging issue that we're facing.
Those aren't opinions. Those are assessments of the scientists.
Let me just finish the point here, because you made very fair points there that are being taken on board, but you also failed to acknowledge what the government has done, what the government has put in place, and the various serious impact that is already happening. And more importantly, the fact that we, as Ireland, is playing our part with our European partners as part of the various climate accords. And that's why we have to make sure that as we go into the new Dáil session, that we have our first carbon budget, that we have the circular economy bill and all those aspects, that we acknowledge the criticism, we acknowledge those who say we're not doing things as well. We dispute where dispute is necessary, but equally we continue the work, that you don't just give up, that you don't just say, oh, well, we're getting criticised, go on. There's a lot of work to do here. And I think actually the work that has started and the tools that have been enabled by the Climate Action Bill will allow us to make good progress.
Cara Augustenberg, would you agree?
Yeah, well, I think we need to remember that the legislation that's just passed, and I'm quite hopeful that this new legislation, because it has carbon budgets, because it will have sectoral emission ceilings in every sector in society, that it will start to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions curve, which we badly need to do. But it was designed to fix the bill that was put forward by Fine Gael and Labour in 2015, because they refused to put carbon budgets in targets in for greenhouse gas emissions. So it didn't reduce emissions as we had hoped. So the proof now as to whether or not the government has changed their stripes and are responding to the climate crisis appropriately is, will they enact new policies that actually do reduce the greenhouse gas emissions? Because we haven't seen policies that have done that to date. So this is really a critical transition point for Ireland.
So the carbon budgets is one thing. It's getting that underlying, let's put a carbon price on everything. But on those areas that I raised there, transport, agriculture, housing, energy and so on, have you any confidence that we're going to meet our targets for 2030?
I think if the government complies with legislation, and they have a tendency to be very aware of their need to comply with legislation, they will have to adhere to this carbon budget. They will have to create emissions, sectoral emission ceilings, which will be in line with this carbon budget. So we will have to have quite a change in all of these things. And we have seen a change in how transport is funded with a new split of a 2-to-1 ratio, where sustainable and active transport is funded at a greater rate than, say, development of new roads. And that's a step forward, but we do need to see big changes, particularly in agriculture, and the acknowledgement that emissions have to reduce, that they can't simply stabilize. And I think this is really the moment where we will see whether or not, you know, the proof is there that there has been a sea change in how the government approaches the climate crisis.
Michael McNamara, what do you say to the farmers in your constituency? Do you say that, look, I'm back the scientists on this, the national herd is going to have to be reduced?
I back the scientists, but I suppose which scientists? Because there is a lot of science around this. You have Dr. Michelle Kane from Oxford talking about how you measure, what is the metric of emissions. And all we have in this bill that passed through the Dáil, which you know, is that the government will bring in a regulation to measure emissions. And how you measure, but how you measure emissions is hugely important, because we know that methane is very damaging. It's 28 times more damaging, a ton of methane.
And this is, this is a speaking point that the IFA has been very keen to introduce into the debate, this creating perhaps confusion around methane. The only accepted measurement by which methane is calculated is that which the IPCC have set out and they adhere to, not this one that Michelle Cain and the IFA prefer.
Except that the IPCC, which you've just referenced, in their report last week pointed to the benefits of using GWP star as the metric by which we measure it. And they say that it's a more effective measure. If you do that, then you focus more on long-term pollutants than short-term, or at least you readdress the balance between the two.
Cara Augustenberg, so, isn't it the case that the IPCC report says that we have to reduce and start with methane and reduce it now?
Yeah, and look, there are lots of different ways to measure these things, and GW star, which Michael refers to, is a good way of showing how methane responds or creates warming and to what extent it creates warming of the atmosphere. However, there is an argument to say that because methane is shorter lived than carbon dioxide, we can actually get greater bang for our buck by addressing that pollutant now, and particularly in Ireland, where right now methane has contributed to 40% of the warming in the last 10 years. Okay. So we really need to
We use GWP star or GWP 100 as a measurement for methane, let's just leave that aside for the moment. Michael McNamara, what I want to hear from you, or what I want to get from you, is, are you saying that you would support the agricultural lobby in saying, no, there shouldn't be any change to the size of the national herd?
No, I mean, I think every sector has to accept change, but that change has to be equitable and fair between the sectors. I mean, we also have to recognise that the national herd in Ireland, contrary to the narrative that's out there, hasn't really increased since 1975 in any way.
Right.
And then you...
That's not true. It went down before going back up again.
No, I mean, look, it was 6,213,000 cattle in Ireland in 1975. There are 6,729,000. So it has increased marginally in
emissions are 15% higher in the last 10 years from methane. So it doesn't matter that it hasn't increased if emissions are going up.
But but that's because you say that there's presumably because you're saying there's an increase in dairy cows. Again, if you go back to 1985, there's the same number of dairy cows in Ireland in 1985 as now. I'm not saying that agriculture doesn't have to get its house in order, but I'm saying that has to be fair. And we also have to avoid carbon leakage, whereby we reduce the number of dairy produce that we produce in Ireland, we reduce the number of beef products that we produce in Ireland, and as a result of that, a greater amount of imports into the European Union are coming from areas which have a far higher carbon footprint in producing dairy produce and in producing beef in particular, like South America and Australia. That is, I think, something that we need to be careful of.
Neil, is the government ultimately going to have to end up saying, I'm sorry to the IFA, the ICSA, the ICMSA, you're going to have to reduce the size of the herd?
I think what the government is very keen to do is to work with those organisations to make sure that the changes that we all acknowledge are necessary are done in a transparent and equitable way. And I go back to the original point.
An answer to my question.
Well, let me go back to my original point and get a little bit more answer there for you. It is making it worth people's while. And there is a lot of opportunities, particularly for those in the agricultural sector, to actually do well out of the challenges ahead of us, to invest in new practices and new approaches that can not only reduce emissions, that can change a thing, but also possibly improve income.
You're talking about just transition. Do you know how much money the government has set aside so far for just transition from the Climate Action Fund? It amounts to €71 million a year. Now, you give more to, as we were saying yesterday, to the greyhound and the thoroughbred industries than you're currently giving to the just transition.
Yeah, and that fund will continue to improve as has been laid out, and we'll see that as part of our carbon budget in the coming weeks, and we'll see a part of the overall budget in October. But you went through about all the different areas that the government has already started work and has already put funding, because this is for every sector of the economy has to approach us, every sector of society, and the government has to lead. And I thoroughly believe within the Climate Action Bill, the government is leading and is providing the templates that can make a meaningful difference.
Patricia, the government is going to be taking on an awful lot of interest groups simultaneously on climate if it's to do the job properly. Big tech in the data centres, the construction industry in housing, the IFA, the ICMSA, all, the alphabet soup of agriculture lobby groups, and not to mention the transport sector and the hauliers and so on. Do you think they're equal to that task?
Well, I think what I'm not hearing in this conversation is how we're going to use what we already have. I mean, we're talking about bringing in 1 million electric vehicles, and that's a target the government has set. But the reality is that the most environmentally friendly vehicle that you can have is the one that you're currently driving, and that you drive it until the end of its useful life, and not encourage people to just change their cars for electric right now, because doing that requires, you know, metals and plastics that will either need to be manufactured or mined, or in the case of materials that have been recycled, they're still going to have to be reprocessed. And all of that is creating an emission in that manufacturing process. So let's teach people how to use things to the end of their natural lives in the first instance, before we start throwing away things that are perfectly serviceable.
Lessons grandma would have told us, basically.
Yeah, but
a bit
also,
of frugality.
Like, I mean, I'm here, I'm listening to this debate about reducing the national herd and about methane emissions. And in my head, I'm going, well, the Cistercian Monastery in Benburb has been using methane gas to generate power for at least 30 years. Why are we not talking about how we can harness that in a useful way to
because
contribute
most
to the
methane
positivity
is belched, you know, not pooed, unfortunately.
A lot of what Patricia is right, and a lot of it is going to be contained in the circular economy bill, and it's all about that, bringing things to their natural end of life, as you rightly say, but also the encouraging the reuse and the reusal, and making it, as I go back to the central point, making it worth people's while to buy into this and provide the supports. That's why we're going to see that this bill coming in is going to clamp down in certain areas, but it's also going to provide the encouragement and the incentivisation as well.
But we also do need to move, and I mean the new CAP budget is moving in that direction, but we do need to make sure that farmers are encouraged and compensated, because at the moment, you know, the most profitable type of farming is perhaps not the most environmentally sensitive type of farming, and we need to make sure that everybody isn't hit equally, that those who already practice an environmentally sensitive type of farming are protected more than those who don't, and that people are encouraged, because the new environmental measures that have been introduced of late are more offer less support than environmental measures which were there 10, 15 years ago. So we do need to make sure that farmers are encouraged as well, because like the Department of Agriculture policy for 30, 40 years now in Ireland has been solely about increase intensification, and there hasn't been, they haven't, with the exception of perhaps Trevor Sargent when he was a junior minister there, they really didn't explore other types of farming, and there is room for both in Ireland, and I think the Department of Agriculture have a lot of work to do in encouraging smaller organic and boutique farming, because like there was a new organic farming scheme opened earlier this year, and there was no uptake in it because it's simply not attractive to farmers at the moment, and we need to examine that and see how can we make it attractive to farmers.
I want to move on now to the vaccine portal opening for the 12 to 15 year olds, and the vaccinations are already underway in that age group, which begs the bigger question here, Neil. When should we lift the last of the restrictions, do you think?
Well, I don't know when the very last restriction will be, but moving on to the next phase of restrictions, because this is the really difficult part of it. The easy part is shutting the country down, and the next easiest approach would be just to open everything up and say, let's go back.
But easy now we're, might not be the best choice of word there.
Well, actually, from a legislative point of view, from a governmental point of view, from getting a community buy-in and making it explainable, it is pretty easy just to shut down the country. It's brutal. It was brutal. We all lived it. It had horrible impacts. But in terms of an impact thing to do, we've seen it around the world, and we've seen other countries have just lifted restrictions really early.
Okay. So what you're saying is more subtle, more nuanced politics is needed now.
And this is the really difficult politics, and it's making sure you identify the areas in a sustainable way while still providing supports for the areas that are still closed, getting people in and getting the buy-in. And the most important thing is, yes, the vaccines are doing brilliantly. Yeah. We've over 6 million now.
The vaccines are doing their job. Science is doing its job. But one of the criticisms that we're hearing most at the moment is for those who are not persuaded by the vaccination programme, all that the government is really doing is just saying, go look at hse.ie.
Well, I don't.
Where's the leadership?
Well, I don't agree with that. And that's why of all the Western world, I think we have the highest take-up of vaccines. And if you look at the percentage in a European perspective, the Irish people have bought into this. We don't have vaccine hesitancy. We don't have that anti-vaccination movement that has bedeviled the French system, or indeed even in the UK. We don't have certain society who are just turning a back on. A lot of
just because we're better than everybody else doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to get to the figures that we need to get to.
But this is the context. You have to compare with the world to see where we're at. And we have to see that what we have underway here is a steady reopening that is getting more people back to work, is limiting the mortality rate, is limiting the hospitality rate, is getting vaccines into arms. And a couple of months ago, we were getting slammed that we didn't have a vaccine rollout, it wasn't happening, but now we do. And the key to getting through the pandemic into a livable stage is maximum vaccine take-up, which we are having in a very sustainable way. And steadily, we'll see more parts of the economy reopen, we'll see bigger numbers allowed of things as the coming weeks progress. And this is really progressive.
Patricia, living your life as you do with a foot in either jurisdiction on the island, do you have a sense, particularly now with the vaccination in 12 to 15 year olds, of there being two very different islands as far as the virus is concerned?
There have been, in terms of the way that the restrictions have been managed, north and south. I mean, for example, in this part of Ireland, if you were vaccinated and you were a close contact of someone who had contracted COVID, you could move about freely if you had no symptoms. Whereas up until, I think, today in the north, you had to quarantine or isolate for 10 days if you were a close contact, regardless of your vaccination status. We've seen differences in the way that hospitality has opened up and how that has affected the COVID rate spiking up and down. But in terms of the vaccination, I think it's been, I think both administrations have done a very good job in terms of the vaccination rollout. At the start, in the north, it was much quicker to get up and running. People were able to get vaccinated much more quickly. But now we're seeing a difference where this part of Ireland is vaccinating 12 to 16 year olds, and the North has to catch up with that. And I think it will do so. One of the biggest concerns, though, that I would have, and it's something that has been covered on the programme this week and by other, other news outlets, is the low rate of uptake of vaccinations amongst pregnant women. And that, I believe, is purely down to a lack of information and a good public information campaign that will reassure people that it is possible
and
to
safely... And not just pointing people to the website.
You know, we're getting into a situation where businesses, employers are going to start making hard decisions about whether or not having a COVID vaccination is going to be a prerequisite for returning to work. So we need to start tackling those conversations as well. If we're allowing people to open up the workplaces, encouraging people to come back into the office, even if it is on a phased basis, a day or two per week, especially if you're in close contact with members of the public, are you going to be required to be vaccinated? This is something that hospitality had to deal with when a lot of the younger people working in that sector weren't vaccinated as hospitality started to reopen outdoors. Now, more of them are able to access the vaccine. But it's a bigger issue. We can't just say, well, you know, it's kind of dealt with itself. Employers are going to have to ask those questions about whether or not it's going to be a prerequisite.
Michael McNamara, I wonder, as a member of the opposition, I registered my 12-year-old for the vaccination yesterday at 8 o'clock in the morning. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I had an appointment for her for Sunday. Would you take your hat off to the government and to the HSE on how well-oiled a machine this operation has now become?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the vaccination machine seems to be operating well, given, I mean, there were difficulties at the start. They were largely down to sourcing vaccines. But I think at this stage, everybody who wants to get a vaccine is in a position to get one. And I think that is how we should operate. I mean, I heard Dr. Gabriel Scally earlier talking about, whether moving to make it compulsory was beneficial or not. And I do think we need to respect that there are people who can't take a vaccine and there are people who don't want to take a vaccine. And, you know, it is acceptable not to want to take a vaccine, I think. I mean, as long I do think people need to inform themselves. I mean, if you look at the
is that your message? Is that the leadership that you're happy to go on national radio and offer
I'm
to people?
I'm happy to go on national radio and feel that I don't have a right to override somebody else's bodily autonomy and make them take a vaccine that they don't want to.
Nobody's asking you to make them, but what about trying to persuade them that it's the right thing to do?
Well, you see, I heard the radio interview with Dr. Scally, and I mean, there is a difference of approach between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom and Ireland with regard to 12 to 15-year-olds. In Ireland, NIAC have recommended that vaccines be made available to 12 to 15-year-olds. They have specifically said they're basing that on there being a psychological and social benefit from doing so. The joint... the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation in Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom, rather, have said that they want more data before they are happy to make it universally available. I think we have to, you know, you're talking about looking at the science. We do have to look at the science. They have said that the
science overwhelmingly says that they work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't doubt that they work. I'm not saying that they don't work.
Are you saying that people need to listen to the scientists and the doctors or a three-minute Facebook clip? Because when you say people...
I'm
making a serious point here, Michael. I'm making a very serious point here. There are people who are vaccine hesitant, who are concerned, and they're taking the time and saying, well, I've informed myself, and they're not looking at the right information. So when you say things like people need to inform themselves, you need to be very specific that there is expert advice. Yeah. That, yes, read the NIAC report, but listen, because if you don't have time to read it, listen to the HSE officials, to the doctors, to the scientists. That's where people inform themselves.
And that is exactly where I am going to have to leave it, I am afraid, ladies and gentlemen. Neil Richmond, Michael McNamara, Patricia McBride and Dr. Cara Augustenberg. We'll take our last break.
Today with Clareburn. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.